From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with literary editor and writer Ted Solotaroff. As a former editor of the New American Review and current senior editor at Harper & Row, Solotaroff has helped establish the careers of many important writers. Also today, I talk with jazz trumpeter, arranger, and bandleader Buck Clayton. In his new autobiography, he reviews his long life in jazz, including his years with the Count Basie Band in the 1930s and 40s. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a compact disc reissue of the late George Zell conducting the Cleveland Orchestra in Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante. And Jan-Harald Brunvand traces the history of another urban legend, this one about the choking Doberman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is literary editor Ted Solotaroff. His new book, A Few Good Voices in My Head, is an anthology of pieces about writing, editing, and reading his contemporaries. Solotaroff has been a significant force in shaping the American literary scene since 1967, when he began editing the literary journal New American Review. In the review and in his work at publishing houses, he's maintained a commitment to emerging writers and a resistance to trendiness. In recent years, he's published several acclaimed first books, including Bobby Ann Mason's first collection of short stories, Joan Chase's novel During the Reign of the Queen of Persia, Sue Miller's The Good Mother, and Lynn Sharon Schwartz's Rough Strife. He's also edited books by Russell Banks, Robert Bly, and Max Appel. Solotaroff has worked as an editor at New American Library, Simon & Schuster, Bantam Books, and Harper & Row, where he's now a senior editor. In an article in this week's Time magazine on yuppie literature, Solotaroff is quoted as describing the books of writers such as Jay McInerney and Bret Easton Ellis as the lifestyle fiction of the 80s. I spoke with Ted Solotaroff earlier today from the NPR studios in New York, and he told me that he sees the success of this literary brat pack as more of a marketing trend than a literary trend.
I think that what you have when publishing becomes as commercial as it is now is that it becomes subject to the same kind of wrinkles of taste that you have in blue jeans or in fresh food, you know. So in fiction, this year it's so-called, you know, yuppie fiction. Last year it was the revival of the short story. Remember there was a big...
Yes, I remember.
And the year before that it was what was called dirt realism, you know, the advent of Ray Carver, Bobby Ann Mason, so on. So that because, you know, people's minds, publishers' minds, and media's minds tend to be almost conditioned by what's hot, what's new, what's, you know, what's trendy. So that whatever happens to fall into that slot for a particular period of time receives an exaggerated amount of attention.
Well, isn't that one of the necessities now for bringing out a book, that there has to be a feature story, a feature angle behind it, so that it will either be the subject of a magazine article or the Phil Donahue show, or that the author can tour on the media circuit? Is that really important?
Well, it certainly is important when you get into the, you know, the bigger advances and so on. I mean, that the question that's asked is not how good is this book, but who's going to buy it? And the second question is, how do you get the book to that big market? As publishing becomes more oriented toward what I call brand name publishing, you know, authors who, you can sell in the same way you sell Rinso or Coca-Cola, so you sell Robert Ludlum or Stephen King. Their particular access to publicity and to media exposure and so on becomes more and more important. With a first novel or a book of ideas, you're just kidding yourself as well as your publisher if you're going to say this writer's going to get on the Donahue show, or this is going to get a, you know, profile in Vanity Fair or what have you. It's only, you know, I think for the more, you know, popular and the more expensive books that this becomes a consideration. However, a mentality develops, which is a marketing mentality, which in time begins to affect the way a house will think of the books, which formerly would have been content to sort of publish and see what happened to them, there now is that kind of orientation which says, you know, how do we promote this book? How do we publicize it? So,
you've always been committed to publishing the work of new fiction writers. Has that become more difficult for you as the publishing industry has become more profit-oriented?
Not for me personally, I don't think, because, you know, I've been doing it long enough, have a track record, and tend to be, you know, more or less trusted, or if not trusted, at least sort of what's the word? In other words, they let me kind of hang around and do my thing. And but the younger editors would have more trouble, I think, than I did, say, when I was starting out 20 years ago, simply because I think there is less publishing of venturesome work. And I don't mean by that. See, that the whole business of the first novel is a way in which publishers and the public themselves kind of kid themselves as to what the openings are, what the access is for, you know, gifted, one-of-a-kind writers. It's a lot easier for me to get a first novel published than it is a novel by a writer who's been publishing for 10, 15 years and hasn't broken out.
Why is that? Oh, because they haven't sold yet, so why are they going to sell now?
Yeah, precisely. And that, you know, with the first novel, there's on the one hand, you know, unlimited vistas of possibility. And secondly, this kind of, you know, sentimental notion and hypocritical notion to some extent. Well, if we're publishing first novels, we're doing our part to, you know, to keep the enterprise going, of putting something back in the pot, you know, the various slogans that publishers use to, as I say, look themselves in the face while they're laughing all the way to the bank.
Right. Yeah. My guest is editor Ted Solotaroff, who has a new collection of pieces that's just been published titled A Few Good Voices in My Head. You've worked with many young writers. I'd like to talk with you about some of your experiences when you were a young writer. And you came to New York when you were young. And you say you wrote that you came to New York sustained by the endless modern legend of the artist as outsider. What did living the artist's life mean to you? What were your expectations?
Well, very different from those I think young writers start out today. Partly because our models were, you know, Joyce or Flaubert, who didn't really get anywhere for 10, 15 years of their careers, and or William Faulkner, you know, publishing novel after novel down there in Jefferson, Mississippi, and no one really paying any attention to him to speak of until he won the Nobel Prize 25 years into his career. The whole notion of the modern artist was that of a sort of marginal, alienated writer who was much more responsible to the happy few, the small community of letters, as it were, than he was to anything like a large audience. And this was not only true in writing, it was also true in painting, it was also true, say, in jazz. I mean, you know, what did someone like Charlie Parker earn in a week? or you know, the painters who later became millionaires were in the 1940s, early 1950s, kind of living the lifestyle of truck drivers in the village.
Well, you were a waiter for many years.
I was a waiter myself, yeah. And one took that for granted. One expected that you would, you know, learn your craft over a period of maybe 10 years and... and if you didn't want to pay those dues, well then, you know, find something else that was easier and more secure and better paying to do. I think so many young writers today come into it with the notion that they too can be, you know, Bret Ellis or Jay McInerney overnight. And their other role models are the rock stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the, what I call the young princes of Soho, the painters of 23 whose canvases are going for $60,000 and up.
So people want success immediately.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole culture is kind of programmed for, you know, your value being in what your market value is. And you know, this is hardly news or for the first time seen on Earth that people should be concerned and motivated to make a lot of money as fast as they can. Capitalism has been around for a long time now. However, there was, you know, that other culture, that alternative culture, which had very little connection to this one, and which kind of supported and encouraged and certainly consoled the writer, the so-called struggling young writer, artist, musician, what have you. Talk today about a struggling young writer, and it's, you're probably talking to someone who already thinks of himself as a failure, which is crazy.
When you were getting started as a writer, you had difficulty writing about your own experiences. You were from a Jewish middle-class family. You didn't really want to write about that. You didn't really want to write about what your life had been like in college or your experiences with the jobs that you've had. Why was it so difficult for you to write about firsthand experiences? What did you think you should be writing about?
Well, it wasn't. It was more a matter of the kind of form that it took. I wrote about my own experience in ways that tended to make it as much like James Joyce's as I could. other writers tried to write about theirs as make it as much like Hemingway's as they could. You know, in other words, that the power of the forms and of the mentors of those forms, like Hemingway, like Joyce, or if you were a poet, like Eliot or Pound or Stevens, William Carlos Williams, tended in a sense to if not engender your experience, certainly push you in one direction or another in choosing what it was to write about. And so you tried to write about things that had large elements in it of ritual, of symbol, of, in other words, that fitted into the modern canon of literature. And, you know, if you're 50 years old and have had a lot of experience and can sort of understand then what experiences were particularly symbolic of the rest of your life, that's a fairly, you know, legitimate way to proceed. But for a 24-year-old to try to take that little pool of experience he somehow managed to pull together and try to find in it, you know, universal meanings and so on is so much to put the cart before the horse that the horse never gets out of the barn.
We were just talking about how when you started writing, you wrote as if it were James Joyce experiencing your life. There's a wonderful revelation that you describe in one of your essays. You say you realized that you didn't want to write about your life because what you wanted from writing was a self different from your own life.
Yeah.
I think that really describes a lot of artists who don't want to write about their own experiences because they hope by virtue of being an artist they'll become somebody more interesting and more different than what they think of themselves as having been. What gave you that revelation?
Well, I think it was mainly just that I had come to the end of that line of trying to have a literary self that was so much, you know, fancier and more sophisticated and more refined than the actual person who was working as a waiter and was, you know, trying to somehow make ends meet. And the whole notion of the artist as some superior being, I think, was quite a dangerous one, as dangerous in its way as the artist as an entrepreneur, as a guy with a product to sell is as dangerous today. I think that one of the ways I sort of began to get out of this was first as a teacher and then as an editor. And I think one of the things that my essays show and that my whole career shows in a way is how editing and writing have been a kind of bonded activities for me. The one tends to not only reinforce the other but to guide it. It was editing that made me begin teaching first, teaching composition, which is a form of editing in a way, which began to make me see that people had to write about what mattered to them for the writing to be any good.
And you could see that as an outsider working with somebody else's writing.
That's right. And the things that really mattered to me didn't seem to be worthy of literature when I was starting out. It was only later on that I realized that I'd made that mistake, which was the revelation you spoke about.
Another revelation you describe in your book that I also very much liked is that you realized by going it alone, by living the solitary artist's life, that you weren't necessarily going to get strength and courage. You might end up being bitter and spiteful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a line in there of Yeats, "Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart." And that's what I was beginning to feel. And it's sort of what made me stop that way of life, go to graduate school, and eventually end up as an editor who found writing criticism made more sense than writing fiction. Though I must say that now in my sort of middle age, I've come back to writing fiction again, though with a much different attitude than I had when I started out.
How is that attitude different?
Oh, well, it's much less burdened by all sorts of voices, bad voices in my head, saying, look who thinks he's a fiction writer. I mean, if James Joyce was a fiction writer, how can you think of yourself as a fiction writer? I don't bother with that kind of self-intimidation anymore.
Well, here's another kind of intimidation. You could experience the editing intimidation. I think a lot of editors are afraid to write fiction because they think that their writers will think, oh, well, he thinks he's such a hot editor. Look at what he's writing. It's no better than what I'm writing.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I sort of figure that any of my authors who say, hey, you know, come on, man, look what you're writing. When you've just been telling me not to write in this way or that way, and now you're doing that. And, you know, I guess I would say, well, look, you know, friend, I if I can't beat you, I have to join you.
Well, I want to talk more about your literary, your experiences in the literary world. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Ted Solotaroff, who is now a senior editor at Harper & Row, and he's been an important literary editor for over 20 years now. There's a new anthology of his essays, which is called A Few Good Voices in My Head. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer and editor Ted Solotaroff is my guest. When you started editing, was it important that you not see yourself as a failed writer?
Well, actually, I did. It was helpful to see myself as one in a way because it I don't think myself so much as failed as kind of misdirected. It helped me to have a certain amount of sympathy and a certain amount of insight into particular problems that writers might have. I mean, every story, every essay, every novel is, to some extent or other, not always, but usually, a failure of one kind or another. It might just be a minor failure, which the editor then comes along and tries to help the author to correct, improve, strengthen, what have you. And that whole, you know, feeling that somehow, even though things haven't worked out or aren't working out entirely well, that still the work can be redeemed is very much part of the editor's philosophy. It tends to put writing into, I think, the right perspective, which is essentially rewriting. One starts out with, you know, kind of setting down a mess, and it's only later on up the road that you are able to see the strength, to see the coherence, to see the import implications of what you've been doing. And I think that so many failed writers fail because they expect that first version to somehow prove their credentials. I was very heartened once to read Thurber talking about how his wife would sometimes go over and look at a first draft he'd written and say, Thurber, you know, that looks like it was written, you know, by you when you were 12. And he would say, precisely, it was. It's the 12-year-old in me who gets those first drafts down. It's only the mature writer who finishes them. And that sense of process, which an editor becomes very, very steeped in, because, you know, you're constantly dealing with the process of a book.
Well, you know, I remember when I interviewed Scott Spencer, he was telling me that he always has to fool himself when he's writing, to fool himself into thinking that everything he's writing is perfect, that it could go right into the printing press. Mm-hmm. Then after he writes it, he realizes what he knew in the back of his mind all along, is that this is several rewrites away from being any good at all. Now, you work with writers who have written thinking, okay, this is ready for the printing presses. They've maybe done several drafts before they've even brought the book to you. And then you sometimes have the job of saying to them, whoa, you've really got to start all over again.
Well, not usually if it's, I mean, if it's something that I'm very interested in, the chances are that, oh, 70, 80% of the book is already there. Otherwise, I'm asking them to write a different book than the one they've written.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful analogy Michelangelo used when someone said, you know, how do you get such wonderful living textures out of marble? And he said, oh, the figure's already in the marble. I just chip away what's covering it. And similarly, in a way, an editor is kind of helping the writer chip away what's covering the final, form, the final power of his work. That's why so much of editing's cutting. Taking out those sentences or paragraphs that aren't necessary, that kind of slow the movement, that obscure the point, and so on.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the question of cutting. You said so much of editing is cutting. I read a lot of books for my work here, hosting this interview program, and I am faced with so many 700-page books that seem like they should have been 200 pages and mm-hmm. some 500-page books that seem like they maybe should have been really good essays, like mm-hmm. one essay. Uh-huh. Could have really summed it up. Is there less cutting away in the publishing world than there used to be? I sometimes think maybe a lot of editors are taking long lunch breaks and not paring away the way they're supposed to be.
Well, that's a large question in a way, because it touches, again, on what we started out with, which is the change of conditions in publishing. What's happened, I think, is publishing stopped being a profession and has become a business. That's a very important distinction, at least in my mind. A profession has certain standards of performance, certain values that really must be respected if you are to call yourself a professional. And editing as a profession is one in which you really deal with a manuscript as you would want your own manuscript to be dealt with if you were on the other side of the editorial desk. That is very carefully, very thoughtfully, very circumspectly, and very honestly. And also very patiently. And that takes time. And with the kind of pressures on editors these days to produce profits and so on, that kind of time is no longer built into the editorial process in the way it used to be. And as a result, there's less editing. That's one reason. The second reason is simply that there's less training of editors than there used to be, because it's not a profession anymore. That editors now are kind of, if they're trained, it's in marketing and attitudes and smarts and so on, rather than in what's called line editing, which is now looked upon as some kind of, you know, sort of dreary trade that a few old-fashioned editors still practice.
You have said over the years that you're really not interested in developing a specific school of writing or in going with one trend in writing, but to look for good fiction in every area mm-hmm. where it exists. Can I ask you, in spite of that, if you think that there's any way of summing up literature in the 80s, if you see any new directions fiction is headed in, or is that a pointless question to ask?
Well, to begin with, I do believe with Henry James that the house of fiction has many windows, and that as a result you honor and respect different kinds of perspectives that fiction brings, that you can love Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald and not have to, you know, say, well, you know, how can you love Hemingway if you love Faulkner? They're such different writers. As for, you know, new trends and tendencies, I'm kind of troubled that by, you know, certain tendencies abroad today, which I'm troubled by minimalism, which, you know, is sort of a leading vogue right now.
Name some of the writers who you would describe as minimalist.
Well, I mean, the really great exemplars of it are people like Ray Carver or, say, Bobby Ann Mason, whom I don't want to fault, but it's a technique which requires, you know, an extreme ability at condensation and at the handling of tone, and because it's really, you know, the less is more kind of philosophy of expression. But as Bill Gass recently said in the Times, with so much minimalism running today, less is indeed less. And it also is a kind of easy way to write. It's almost like, you know, a kind of a painting you can draw by following the numbers. So the minimal fiction has very easy formulas to follow. The present tense, which makes everything, you know, very accessible and simple and immediate and so on. The fact that characters are not reflective at all. It's almost like Hemingway wrung dry in a certain way. And I think that this is a problem not only for fiction, but in terms of our whole relation of fiction to society, that it appeals to the short attention span. It appeals to the lack of reflectiveness, to the to a kind of what I can only call literary consumerism. You know, here it's like sun-dried tomatoes. You know, here they are. They're not. It's small. It's compact. You know, you can digest them quickly, and you don't really have to prepare them, what have you. You just consume them, and so much minimal fiction is that way.
You know, we're just about out of time, but there's a couple of things I want to ask you really quickly. One is that I was surprised to hear you mention Bobby Mason in the category you were just criticizing, because you edited her first collection of stories.
That's right. Can misunderstand me, that masters are masters, and she's a master of minimal fiction. It's just that, that, you know, as say with Henry Miller, it had a whole lot of heavy breathing male writers suddenly, you know, writing about one orgasm after another. it just proved to be, you know, a kind of dead end. And so it's not the masters that I'm concerned about. It's the vogue of imitation.
Well, one last question. When you're writing fiction or essays and you get edited by somebody else, is that a difficult experience for you? Do you ever second-guess them, thinking, well, if I were editing this, I would do it differently?
I've had my good experiences and bad experiences. The good ones are people who sort of follow the same kind of advice I try to follow when I'm on the other side of the desk, and that is handle my manuscript as you would like yours to be handled if you were the writer. And that means that you're careful, it means that you're patient, it means that you're honest, it means that you're, and it means you know what you're doing. It means you know what you're doing, that you're an experienced editor. An experienced editor is like an experienced obstetrician. He's very good at deliveries.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your editing and your writing. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
My guest has been Ted Solotaroff, and he's been one of the major literary editors in the book publishing world for about the past 20 years. He's now a senior editor at Harper & Row. A new collection of his pieces on writing, editing, and literary criticism has just been published. It's called A Few Good Voices in My Head, and the publisher is Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Cousin Brucey, Bruce Morrow, who used to be one of the top 40 DJs in the 1960s in New York, one of the biggest DJs in the country. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Buck Clayton talks about his long life in jazz as a trumpeter with the Count Basie Band in the 30s and 40s, and more recently, leading all-star jam sessions. He's just written an autobiography called Buck Clayton's Jazz World. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a compact disc reissue of Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante, performed by the Cleveland Orchestra under the baton of the late George Zell. And Jan Harald Brundvand gets to the bottom of another urban legend, this one about the choking Doberman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan defended his nominee to the Supreme Court, Robert H. Bork, in a nationally broadcast address today. The president lashed out at Bork's opponents, saying the tactics they used to derail the nomination of Judge Bork were an ugly spectacle.
If the campaign of distortion and disinformation used by opponents of this nominee is allowed to succeed, it will represent more than a temporary setback for one candidate or the administration. It will permanently diminish the sum total of American democracy. It will call into question the idea of free, fair, and civil exchange. And it will mean that on critical issues, like the fight against crime and drugs, and keeping those who are unelected from unconstitutionally taking power into their own hands, each of us and each of our children will be the losers.
None of the three major television networks carried the president's statement. The cable news networks and at least one radio network broadcast the speech live. The winners of the Nobel Prizes in Physics and Chemistry were announced today. Former DuPont researcher Charles Peterson will share the chemistry honor with Donald Cram of UCLA and French researcher Jean-Marie Len for their work in synthesizing molecules that can mimic important biological functions. The physics award will go to Alex Mueller of Switzerland and George Bednors of West Germany. They were recognized for developing new superconducting materials that may lead to more powerful computers and faster trains. New fighting broke out today in the Persian Gulf. This time, the clash was on the border between Oman and South Yemen. UPI's John Phillips reports.
Fighting has flared between border patrols on the strategic frontier between pro-Western Oman and the Marxist state of South Yemen. At least 8 Yemeni soldiers and 2 Omanis were killed in the clashes. The trouble started Sunday, but has only just been reported following a disclosure by a Kuwaiti newspaper. Oman put down a Marxist separatist rebellion in the border region's Dhofar province in the 1970s with British help. Western citizens were evacuated from South Yemen last year during a bloody palace revolution against the pro-Soviet regime. The latest clashes are reported to have died down following mediation by Sheikh Zayed of the United Arab Emirates. But such signs of instability in the Gulf region are bound to be of major concern to Western military commanders who use Oman as one of their major base points. John Phillips, Bahrain.
Searchers say they've found evidence that a French biplane that disappeared 60 years ago may have crashed in eastern Maine. 2 French flyers disappeared in an attempt to fly their plane, the White Bird, from Paris to New York, just days before Charles Lindbergh's successful flight. Andrea De Leon of Maine Public Radio reports.
Members of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery say they may be on the verge of discovering the remains of the historic White Bird. Experts have confirmed that a decaying strip of fiber found in the woods of Washington County may have come from the plane's wing. The site of the discovery correlates with the taped testimony of 4 people who remember hearing a plane crash 60 years ago at a time when few planes ventured into the skies above eastern Maine. Tomorrow, members of the search team will begin excavating the area where the strip was found. If they are able to prove that the French team reached the United States, the discovery will do little to alter Charles Lindbergh's place in history. Lindbergh won the record for flying nonstop between New York and Paris. Even if the remains of François Colli and Charles Nungesser turn up in Maine, they will have fallen short of that goal. But group members say such a discovery will put to rest one of aviation's greatest mysteries. For National Public Radio, this is Andrea De Leon in Portland, Maine.
The U.S. trade deficit rose by $800 million in August. The unexpectedly high deficit caused a sharp drop on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 95 points. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review of a new reissue featuring the late George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra. Zell was one of the last of a breed of European-born conductors who were known for their almost tyrannical style. But in his 24 years with Cleveland, he made it one of the foremost orchestras in the country. This new recording has inspired Lloyd to reassess his opinion of Zell.
I've never been a fan of George Zell, the late conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra who died in 1970. He certainly got a brilliant sound out of that orchestra, a precision and beauty that one can still hear in its playing today. But there was something tight-lipped about his music-making, rigid, inexpressive, mincing, and dry. CBS has been reissuing Zell records in its budget Great Performances series on CD, and the cleaned-up sound helps me understand more of the claims made by people who liked his live performances. The delicacy, if not the warmth, of his conducting on the famous set of Beethoven piano concertos he did with Leon Fleischer holds up better than I would have expected. And Fleischer, who can no longer play this repertoire because he can't rely on his right hand, gives one of the most radiantly complex piano performances ever recorded. CBS has just reissued a Zell record I never heard or heard of when it was originally released. And along with the Beethoven concertos, it's forcing me to revise my attitude toward Zell. Or at least, it's making me willing to listen to all his old records again. It's Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante for violin, viola, and orchestra, one of his most enchanting and ambitious works. He wrote it when he was 23 and coming into his full maturity. It's a concerto for two solo instruments, something like a Baroque concerto grosso, except that Mozart stretches the form to its most symphonic limits. It's a brilliant work. In fact, Mozart wants the viola strings to be tuned a half tone higher to intensify that brilliance. But it also gets to be mysteriously deep, not only in its sublime central slow movement, but also in the large-scale structure of its fast movements. Here's the opening section. The soloists for Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante are Cleveland Orchestra violist Abraham Skernick and violinist Raphael Druyan, one of the unsung great musicians of our time. After Zell's death, when his principal guest conductor, Pierre Boulez, became music director of the New York Philharmonic, he insisted Druyan come with him as concertmaster. This 1964 Zell performance works because of its elegance, its refined classicism and restraint. It's not as exhilarating as the famous 1933 Hamilton Hardy recording with Lionel Tertis, who was probably the greatest viola player of this century. Nor is it as profound, or probing, or giving as the great 1951 Pablo Casals performance with Isaac Stern and William Primrose. The Casals slow movement is over 2 minutes longer than Zell's. Nor does the Mozart clarinet concerto that completes this Zell disc approach the expansive and piercing performance by Sir Thomas Beecham with clarinetist Jack Brimer, which has just been reissued on an Angel CD. Still, these Zell recordings are eloquent versions of a legitimate musical style. It's good to know them, and I never thought I'd say that about anything by Zell.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a new reissue of George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra playing Mozart on the CBS Masterworks label. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the 75-year-old trumpeter Buck Clayton. He reminisces about his long life in jazz in his new autobiography, Buck Clayton's Jazz World. Clayton was one of the great sidemen in the Count Basie Band from 1936 to 43. Of all the records he made with Basie, his favorite is Fiesta in Blue. After his years with Basie, Clayton recorded dozens of records, some with fellow Basie alumni like Billie Holiday, Jimmy Rushing, and Dickie Wells, others with jazz greats like Benny Goodman and Teddy Wilson. Clayton grew up in Parsons, Kansas. As a teenager, he ran away from home and jumped a freight train to Los Angeles to be closer to a jazz scene. But he got his break with Basie close to home while passing through Kansas City.
I actually was on my way to join Willie Brandt in New York City. But on the way, I stopped to visit my mother in Parsons, which is about a two-hour ride from Kansas City. And after I saw my mother and my family, then I went to Kansas City to listen to these guys that I'd heard so much about, Basie and Joe Jones and Lester. And it was right there that... The band just knocked me out. I never heard anything like it. And Lips Page had just left the band. So Basie asked me would I join. And I didn't tell him yes right away. I thought about it, but I was a little bit afraid of taking Lips Page's chair because I had heard about Lips all my life as a great trumpet player. But anyway, after a couple of days, I decided to join Basie because I knew they were going to New York anyway.
He had no money to pay you. How did they work it out?
Well, everybody was making $2 and a quarter a night before I got there. $14 a week, a little more. So they all chipped in the quarter and made my salary, which made my salary come to $2 a night.
After you joined the Basie Band, the band went to New York. Were you ready for New York when you got there? Were you prepared for it?
Well, we thought we were, till we ran into Woody Herman. And that kind of showed us that we had a lot more to learn. Because Woody kind of embarrassed us in the Roseland Ballroom.
How did he embarrass you?
They played the same number that we played and played it better than we did. So we were a little upset about that. But anyway, we were put back on the road again. We weren't quite ready yet. So we had to get back on the one-nighters and rehearse some more.
When the band came to New York, you weren't all used to recording contracts and the New York club scene. Was Basie initially a little bit naive about how to handle the economics of the big band life in New York?
Yes, he was. Very much. Basie didn't know anything about anything when we first got to New York. But he learned later. He got stung quite a bit. Several promoters took advantage of it, you know. They would tell Basie, this is count, we don't want you to worry about anything. We don't want you to pay. Don't worry about your bills. You just take care of the music. So they would give Basie a checkbook, a full checkbook, and tell him to sign his name on the bottom. And we'll take care of it, you know. And he did. He signed the whole thing. And on, I think, the first 15 numbers we made, he signed all of the copyright over to the recorders. So he didn't get any royalties for so many of the things that we did.
Your very first recording session was in 1937, accompanying Billie Holiday.
Mm-hmm.
In your autobiography, you write about how you liked to play during her breaths and that you'd watch her mouth when she was singing to see when she was breathing. Could you explain how you would do that?
Well, they would put me very close to Billie. In fact, we used the same mic. And I could watch her. And when she phrased a certain segment of the music, I would be sure not to play while she was singing in that. But as soon as she would stop to go into another phrase, I would come in with what we call filling up the windows. It's just to, you know, to keep it going until she got ready to come back for the next phrase and I'd cool out.
When we want to love, we love. When we want to kiss, we kiss. With a little petting, we're getting some fun out of life. When we want to work, we work. When we want to play, we play. In a happy setting, we're getting out of life.
After the war, you did a lot of playing in your own groups and other people's groups. You toured, you played New York. You were really quite active until you had a lip problem, and this was in the late 1960s, I think, that your lip first started to give you trouble. What went wrong? I think this is a trumpeter's nightmare that something's going to happen to their lip.
Yes, it is. But my trouble was with my teeth. Because years before that, I had broken a tooth, and that's very deadly. A trumpet player breaks his teeth. And as a result, I had to have a bridge made. And then when the bridge was made, as I got older, my gums receded, but the bridge didn't recede, and it left a little thing in there that was cut my lip every time I'd play. And from then on, that's when the trouble started. And I just had to depend on arranging and composing.
Have you been able to play since?
Oh, I don't even try now. I don't play anymore. I haven't played for about 10 years.
Have you missed it a lot?
No, because I'm just as interested in writing as I was in playing, maybe a little more.
So what's the latest band that you're working with now?
Well, the latest band, I have a group formed in New York where everybody has at one time played with big bands. They're all stars, but they like to play my arrangements.
And will you be in front of the band conducting?
I'll be doing that.
Well, great. I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Buck Clayton's memoir is titled Buck Clayton's Jazz World. He'll perform with his new band at Fat Tuesdays in New York from October 27th until November 1st. Here's a sample of how the new band sounds. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
We have a report on a U.S. Department of Education plan for national certification of teachers, a visit to Atwater, Minnesota, a farm community that was hard hit by the farm debt crisis just a couple of years ago, to find out how they're doing now, and also a report on President Reagan's televised and broadcast talk on behalf of Judge Robert Bork. He said he still supports the nomination of Judge Bork to the Supreme Court and urges people to call their senators and urge them to vote in favor of his nominee.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Jan Harald Brunvand tracks urban legends. Today he shares the one about the choking Doberman.
I heard a dog story recently from a couple of people in the Midwest who wondered whether it qualifies as an urban legend. It seems that a young woman who lived alone returned home to find her Doberman choking. She immediately drove the dog to her veterinarian. The vet informed her that it might take several hours to correct the problem, so he told her to return home and he would call her up later. Her phone was ringing when she unlocked her door, and it was the vet. To her amazement, he told her to leave the house immediately. No questions, just leave. The police arrived a few moments later, for the vet had also called them. They searched the house, and they found a burglar hiding in the hall closet, clutching his bloody hand. The Doberman had been choking on two of the burglar's fingers, which it had bitten off. I told my sources of the story that they guessed correctly, because this grim episode is fiction, not fact. The choking Doberman is a classic example of an old European legend updated with modern American themes. The ancestor of the story is a legend from Wales in which Prince Llewellyn returns home where he's left his hunting hound guarding the baby. He discovers the dog collapsed at the open door, covered with blood. The prince looks inside to see the baby's crib overturned and empty. Believing that the dog has attacked the child, the prince kills the animal, only to find when he actually enters the home that the baby is safe, and a huge wolf that the dog had fought off is lying dead on the floor. While many Welsh folk regard this story as a true incident, The essential plot occurs elsewhere in Europe and in the Middle East. In Crossing the Atlantic, this European story first became The Trapper and His Dog, a Yukon tragedy. Eventually, it mutated away from the baby being saved into our modern account of a young urban woman living alone who is saved by her dog. The wolf turns into a human intruder. The number of fingers varies, along with the breed of dog, the hiding place of the intruder, and the exact words of the veterinarian. The first time I heard the Choking Doberman story, it reminded me of another urban legend about a babysitter who receives threatening phone calls. An operator succeeds in tracing one of the calls and then warns her to get out of the house right away, no questions asked. It turns out that the caller has been phoning from an upstairs extension and that the warning comes in the nick of time, for he's just coming downstairs, knife in hand. In both legends, we have a telephoned warning against a hidden intruder. The near victim in these legends is almost always a young, single woman, and the burglar and rescuer are males. It is sometimes mentioned that the woman's father or boyfriend gave her the Doberman, or he recommended that she get one for her protection. So urban legends also often perpetuate cultural stereotypes. I've heard the Choking Doberman story told by both men and women. For men, the story portrays women as helpless victims. For women, it reveals a world in which men are both threatening and authoritative.
Jan Harald Brunvand is a professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. Write us at Fresh Air with urban legends you've heard, and we'll pass them on to him. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my arms, I'll never.
Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Anne Donencourt, the director of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which is exhibiting a Marcel Duchamp retrospective in celebration of the 100th anniversary of his birth. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review All Fired Up, the new album from country rocker Bobby Lee Springfield. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Baby Boom, starring Diane Keaton and Sam Shepard. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.